So we have got our parties into court. Now, our focus is on how cases are decided in court. So we are looking at courtroom arguments as far as there is any forms of proof, the actual judgment, and what the winner obtains as a result of judgment. I am Emanuele Conte, and I'm discussing about all this with John Hudson, Mark McAfee, Attilio Stella, and Sarah White. John, do you want to begin?
Yes, in England, there might be no pleading in the sense that the question would simply be put to the recognators, to the jurors. And the question will be something like, was the plaintiff dissuaded unjustly and without judgment by the defendant within the limitation period of the assize, yes or no? But there were certain exceptions which could be raised by the defendant. By exceptions, I mean arguments raised which, if accepted by the court, would defeat the action. These could take various forms. The typical one would be that the tenement in dispute wasn't a free tenement at all. For example, it might be held in villainage. A defendant might alternatively argue that the alleged dissuasion happened outside the limitation period set by the action. Pleading could also address the content of the writ. For example, whether the correct defendant is named on the writ. If it was not the correct defendant, a new writ might have to be obtained.
What about France, Matt?
So in France, the case typically begins with the plaintiff alleging that he or she has been dispossessed. And the complaint centered on a factual statement here, so X dispossessed Y of property. Plaintiffs usually also included reasons for why the dispossession had been committed wrongly. They might emphasize, for example, their long tenure, or that they had inherited the property from their predecessors, thereby intimating legitimacy of their title. The defendant then had three options in response to this accusation. He or she could either admit to the allegations and restore possession to the plaintiff. The second option was to deny the allegations altogether, or the third option was to admit to the act of dispossession but offer a defense, excusing those actions. If the defendant denied the allegations, this typically would lead to an adjournment, allowing both parties to gather witnesses. And the purpose of subsequent hearings would then be to establish whether or not the defendant did, in fact, commit the dispossession. If the defendant admitted to the allegations but offered a defense, then this resulted in a delay to the case for both parties to prepare for further pleading. Defenses might seek to excuse the defendant's actions, i.e., the dispossession was justified, perhaps because there is some fault with the plaintiff's tenure. Or defendants might claim that the court in which the current hearing was underway did not have jurisdiction over this particular case. So there was some scope for argument in these actions. In practice, this means that cases over dispossession often blurred questions of fact, i.e., dispossession, and substantive questions of right or title. And this does seem to have been a concern, at least for some customary legal jurists. Beaumanoir, writing in the early 1280s, for example, is explicit that cases of novel dissaisin cannot be combined with claims for ownership.
Attilio, what about Italy?
Although self-help seems to have long survived, in northern Italy, cases of dispossession generally followed ordinary procedure inspired by Roman law, at least from the late 12th century onwards. According to this procedure, when a court has accepted a plaintiff's libel and both parties have responded to the summons and put warranties, at this point, the defendant can either confess and renounce his defense, in which circumstances he loses the case, or decide to defend himself, and so the case proceeds. This means that he can now oppose exceptions based on either points of law or fact. For instance, he can oppose that he's a minor and cannot defend himself, or he can say that dispossession never took place, etc. These exceptions, therefore, aim to either delay or disrupt the case. Consequently, some of them address the court officials, some others the plaintiff, who has to respond. So there is a first confrontation between parties, which allows court officials to draw a list of main issues and minor points that parties intend to prove. They are called intenciones. For instance, if the main issue is the dispossession of some land, the secondary issue could be the loss of revenues or the loss of services from tenants. Other minor points could be the material circumstances in which the alleged dispossession took place or the entity of damages. This first confrontation, however, very often resulted into the multiplication of the points to be proved, with a significant risk of slowing down the working of justice. So the Italian courts introduced a new procedural step called posiciones, which aimed at limiting the number of these points. Parties were compelled to confront themselves a second time on each point. A party would make a statement and the opponent could confirm or deny it. For instance, if one of the points concerned, say, some unpaid rent, one party could allege that the opponent did not pay it for 3 years. And then the opponent can say, no, it's not true. And so the other party would rephrase the question, say that the rent was not paid for 2 years, and so on, until hopefully parties would agree on that specific matter and move to another one. The result may not be the determination of real facts, but just an agreement about the circumstances, about an agreement about what happened, let's say. Therefore, the idea posiciones is that if two parties agree, or better, are induced to agree upon a fact, the judge doesn't need to prove that fact. He just needs to apply the law to it. Ultimately, therefore, these strategy, these new procedural steps, would help officials to minimize the points to be proved through witnesses or charters.
This is very interesting, actually. There are any similarities with canon law procedure, Sarah?
Yes, definitely. In the ecclesiastical courts, things happen very much like what Attilio, Matt, and John have just explained. The defendant could either confess, deny the allegations, or put forward an affirmative defense that conceded the suit was valid, but offered additional material that would deny the plaintiff's entitlement to relief. Argument after this could be made through dilatory or peremptory exceptions, and some argument actually took place before the issue was joined, in the period when the parties were deciding what the details of the litigation would be. These arguments were presented as exceptions and replications to the libel. So, for example, that the properties named in the libel were not correct. And sometimes the other party might put forward a counterclaim at this point, too. After the parties had joined issue, they would then draw up a list of articles or points they intended to prove. And this is where we have statements put forward such as, so-and-so is not the rector of the church because he was not canonically appointed. And these are usually concluded with a clause stating that the parties are not held to prove all the articles, but only enough to conclude the case. And sometimes posiciones, like the ones Attilio mentioned, are also put forward at this point. Then the parties would bring their proofs, like witnesses, in support of their articles, and the other party could present arguments against them. And we actually do have some mentions of argument taking place in court sessions, although unfortunately we rarely have a record of this.
So next step would be, how are matters of fact decided? John, do you want to tell us something about Normandy and England?
The procedure in England and in Normandy are very similar. The case is decided by a recognition. This means that 12 law-worthy men, when panelled to swear on oath, whether the issue put to them had happened or not. That is, whether the alleged disseisin, unjust and without judgment, had taken place. They give an answer, and that decides the matters of fact.
It was the same also in France, Matt.
Yeah, it was roughly similar. So there were several methods for establishing matters of fact in northern France. Like what John has just described for Normandy and England, we do have evidence for inquests, or enquête, from the 12th century. So again, this is the testimony of a sworn group of jurors who might determine whether or not the dispossession took place. The coutumiers, the texts from the 13th century, also refer to inspection days, whereby the parties and judges would go to the property in question to establish the facts. And in such situations, some form of sworn inquest was probably normal. Because the defendant might introduce a number of exceptions, however, novel disseisin cases might also require additional or alternative forms of proof. The coutumier tend only to mention that one or both parties might need to furnish proof without specifying what forms of proof were normal in these cases specifically, i.e. novel disseisin cases. The surviving case material from the Parlement in Paris shows a mix of collective sworn testimony from people identified as jurors, as well as the use of documentary proof, individual witness testimony, oaths, etc. In such cases, the judges or judicial officials were responsible for evaluating the proofs of each party and making a decision based upon them.
I wonder if the procedure was the same also at canon law, Sarah.
In the ecclesiastical courts, the judge would decide matters of fact on the proofs and arguments presented by the parties, as they would in any other type of case. And witnesses and documents are the most common forms of proof, although not the only ones. Witnesses were usually interviewed according to a list of questions called interrogatories, which were based on the articles I had just mentioned. In dispossession cases, the questions often would concern things such as whether the witnesses saw the incumbent inducted into the church, whether they saw him behave as the rector, whether they saw the eviction take place, things like that. After this, the parties could then bring their exceptions and their arguments against the statements of the witnesses, which would then be proved by more witnesses in turn. These exceptions could be against the persons of the witnesses, or, for example, arguments that what they said could not be true because there was proof to the contrary. Then the judge would have to decide whose witnesses seemed the most trustworthy, based on their persons or the consistency of their testimony, keeping in mind, of course, any arguments that had been made against the witnesses by the opposing party.
So probably it have influenced the Italian practice. Is this true, Attilio?
Well, you can say yes. I can say yes. Let's start with a distinction, because inquiry through oath takers is also something that you see in Italy until the late 12th century, at least. And this is something that is also stated in the Libri Feudorum, for instance. Although I couldn't find any cases related to dispossession specifically. However, this is something that loses importance as long as a Romano-canonical procedure gains authority. Then, quite similarly to canon law, probably inspired by canon law, matters of fact are decided by a judge based on proofs presented by parties, mainly through written proof and witnesses. Matters of fact are determined on the shortlist of points, as I said earlier, that the court officials have drawn in the earlier stages of the trial, however.
Oh, I see. And now we come to a very crucial point. Who makes the judgment?
Well, in North Italian courts, a civic official, usually a judge or a consul, makes the judgment. But in doing so, he is usually supported by a panel of colleagues, usually other civic judges and possibly milites, knights. As the 13th century progresses, the number of officials required to legitimate a judgment decreases. We might say that there is a slow, progressive movement from collective judgments to individual and more procedural choices committed to just one or two officials. And I think that this can be seen as a consequence of the increasing amount of litigation that reached the civic courts in Italy at that time.
Oh, I see. And what about canon law, Sarah?
Well, in canon law, the case would be decided by the judge, and this would be either the archdeacon, the bishop, or an official that they had delegated their jurisdiction to. And this decision was usually made with the aid of legal experts who were attached to the court. The judge would then summon the parties and pronounce the sentence in their presence. Or it was possible for him to make a default judgment if one of the parties didn't appear in court.
And what about France, Matt?
In France, typically, the award of judgment would be made by the judge or the officials of the court. So in the lay courts of northern France, for example, the judge might ordinarily be the lord who has jurisdiction in such a case, or more usually, someone acting as the lord's delegate, such as a provost, a prévôt, a bailli, or a seneschal. And we also know that from the royal courts, whose records begin in 1254, there's a trend towards increasing professionalization of the judges, at least in the royal courts, a mix of lay and ecclesiastical figures, but figures with some degree of professional training.
Was England different, John?
England's in many ways the same as France, in particular what Matt was describing at the end. In England, and it's the same in Normandy, it's the recognitors who deliver their sworn verdict, and it's this verdict which decides the case. But then the result is formally confirmed, and in that sense the judgment is made, by the court, that is, the royal justices who were presiding over the assize.
So you won the case. You get the possession and the dispute. But do you get anything else, such as expenses or compensation?
Well, in the ecclesiastical courts, the loser of the case usually has to pay the winning party's litigation expenses. It was also possible to receive the back revenues from the property that you should have received while the property was wrongfully detained. But this would only be awarded if a request had been made in the libel, that is, if this request was part of the litigation from the very beginning.
In Italy, was the same, Attilio?
Well, we can say that in northern Italy, you can get possession, compensation for damage received, such as back revenues and lost services, but also further compensation. As in canon law, to obtain that, one had to specify the request in the libel. The Constitutio Sequicintanta, for instance, allowed both recovery of the dispossessed thing and the payment of a penalty, usually of the same value of the possession under dispute, but only if this was expressly stated in the libel.
And what were the consequences of the judgment in England, John?
What Attilio says is interesting, because there seems to be a penal element within novel deces in England as well. The late 12th century English treatise, known as Glanville, states, and I quote, "The losing party, whether appellor or appellee, shall always be liable to amercement by the Lord King on account of the violent disseisin." Amercement here means a fine. Obviously, demanding a fine from the losing defendant suggests a penal element, although the extension of this to a losing plaintiff raises further questions. Was it to punish an unjust allegation, to deter spurious claims, or was it simply a good source of revenue for the king? So novel deces doesn't simply seem to be an action about a thing. There's an element of punishment involved as well. As for compensation to the injured party, at first it seems that the successful plaintiff could recover not just the lands, but the product of the lands too, although this isn't strictly what we now understand as damages, that is, monetary compensation to account for unjust loss. However, in the 13th century, we see the recognitors being asked to assess the monetary value of the damages the plaintiff had suffered, and this would be recovered along with the land. Of course, the longer the limitation period of the action, the further back the original event could have occurred, and therefore the longer the potential period between the disseisin and the action coming to the court, the more significant the issue of damages became, and also the less likely the fruits of the land to have survived to be given back to the successful claimant.
What about France, Matt?
France is very similar to what John has just described for England. So beyond losing possession of the disputed property, the defeated party in novel deces cases was also required to pay the winning party's expenses and damages and to pay a fine to the court holder. So expenses in these contexts refer to any costs incurred as part of the lawsuit. This might include lawyers' fees, paying for witnesses, and we're to imagine here paying for their accommodation or food or sustenance, and other fees that would be associated with the pursuit of the case. Damages were connected to the loss of proceeds from the property itself. And as John was saying, for England, we should think here both of things physically taken from the property as well as kind of a broader sense of revenue. Defeated parties thus had to restore whatever they had actually taken or collected from the property whilst it was in their possession. And in some cases, it seems that winning parties also wanted restitution based on the potential proceeds of the disputed property. So the idea here may have been that the winning party, i.e. the party that successfully defeated the other in a case of novel disseisin, would have been able to extract more from the property than the losing party in fact did. So there's an economic element at play here. Now, in claiming both expenses and damages, the claimant was meant to swear an oath that his or her claims were just, and there may have been additional inquests or inquiries made concerning the amounts that the individual was claiming. If we turn to the fine, this went to the court holder, either the court holder alone or the court holder along with any others who had a right to judicial fines in this particular case or jurisdiction. According to Beaumanoir, the value of the fine was 60 sous. And there's an important clue in this amount which speaks to the quasi-criminal element of novel disseisin. 60 sous was the standard amount for the four major cases of homicide, arson, rape, and theft. That novel disseisin was fined at the same value certainly indicates the conceptual relationship between it on the one hand and offences that we would classify as criminal on the other.
These are the consequences of judgment. Now, what are the possibilities of reopening the dispute? Matt?
After judgment, the defeated party seems to have had a couple of options. One was to appeal to a higher jurisdiction, usually the Crown, saying that either the judgment itself was wrong, or that the court producing the judgment did not, in fact, have the authority to do so. The other main option, open to the defeated party, was to bring a suit for ownership of the disputed property. This could lead to a rather bizarre hypothetical consequence. Beaumanoir, for instance, imagines a scenario in which someone, let's call them A, regains possession in a case of novel disseisin, only to later be hanged. Because novel disseisin, at least according to Beaumanoir, only determines the fact of dispossession, irrespective of ownership, it could transpire that the person who did the dispossessing, B, was trying to recover property that A had stolen from them. If B could then prove A's theft, then A would be hanged, despite having earlier gained possession successfully through an action of novel disseisin. How serious a problem this was in practice, however, is not so clear.
What about England and Normandy, John?
I don't think from England or Normandy we have the sort of hypothetical situation that Beaumanoir is playing around with. But apart from that, there's the distinct similarities. You might proceed by saying that the people making the verdict, the recognitors, had acted dishonestly. In England, your first step here would be to obtain a writ of attaint from the Royal Chancery. Second, you might use a process through what became known in England as a writ of certification, which investigates an error in the verdict or in the procedure followed. Thirdly, and again Matt has mentioned something similar, you might proceed through what is referred to as dual process, by which is meant bringing an action concerning property as opposed to possession. That is, you would go in England to the Royal Chancery and seek a writ of right, whereby you established your right, your title of ownership to the possession which had been contested.
What were the possibility of reopening the trial at canon law, Sarah?
In the ecclesiastical courts, it was far more common for the party to appeal, probably because you have the possibility to appeal. And this has to be done within 10 days of the sentence. But if there were extenuating circumstances, it was possible to appeal later, so long as it was within 1 year of the sentence. The appeal had to be made to a higher judge than the one in the initial case, according to the ecclesiastical hierarchy. So if the sentence had been given by an archdeacon, you would appeal to the bishop, or by a bishop to the archbishop, and so on. Eventually, if you wanted, you could appeal to Rome. If you did appeal to Rome, you'd be given 2 years in which to prosecute the appeal due to the distance that had to be travelled. Appeals were most often made on procedural or jurisdictional grounds, like Matt had mentioned. And it was also possible to sue for proprietary rights as opposed to possessory rights if this had not been part of the previous litigation. But as I said, it seems to have been more common to appeal the case. And the second option is only mentioned in the procedural treatises, in which the sections on possession are almost entirely based on Roman law.
I see. And it was possible to appeal also in Italy at Tilio?
Yes, one could reopen a case through appeal, which could be granted by the civic courts, quite paradoxically the same civic courts which had judged the first instance. The judges of appeals, who were judges specifically appointed to these sort of cases, usually emerged in the early 13th century. In general, this path could be sought in cases that had been poorly managed by court officials, mainly for serious breaches of ordinary procedure. And I found some cases, quite odd cases and very rare, in which appeal against a civic court's judgment was made to an ecclesiastical court, but such strategies usually did not succeed. Of course, as Sarah suggested, one could always bring an action for proprietary rights, a reivindicatio, but only if it was competent and it was not the object of the first case. But this option could entail several risks, not least the fact that judges tended to defend the possessor's claims, and after losing a possessory action, and if say that the winner of the first case was awarded or remain in possession of the good, or the disputed land, the chances of succeeding through a proprietary action could be very low.
Thank you very much. As with other aspects of procedure, we have similarities between England and northern and western France, and between canon law and North Italy. We have seen that in general, decisions rest on matters of fact, or matters of mixed fact and law, for example, the issue of villeinage. However, certain aspects of procedure may also have opened up possibilities of more abstract legal thinking. And this is one issue that we will consider next in our final episode. Thank you.